Thank you, Alessia. Thank you very much also for the invitation. And yeah, it's really a great pleasure to come back to this group and to this quantum gravity group and talk about my recent work. Work, in fact, that somewhat connects what I've been doing at PI and what I would like to do now in the future. And let's go to the first slide. The talk is divided into three main parts. First of all, I would like to give a general introduction and motivation. And then I will go on into more technical aspects. So let's go on to the first part of the talk. What I'm interested in here, or this connects to a lot of work that is now also happening at Perimeter Institute in your group, but which really connects different issues coming together from different communities. The question is how to, or the main theme of this program or this viewpoint on quantum gravity is how to localize the gravitational degrees of freedom in finite domains, in domains with boundaries. So we are considering the gravitational degrees of freedom in a finite region, in a region, so this line stands for partial Cauchy hypersurface that is bounded. And we are interested in this problem from different angles. So on the one hand, it is related to, so one possible viewpoint is that it is simply a gauge fixing. We want to ultimately, or in here, I'm considering the case where the gravitational degrees of freedom are recorded at the null boundary. And in a way, this is, or one way of looking at this is to say that in gravity, diffeomorphisms are gauge symmetries, and states on diffeomorphically equivalent surfaces are gauge equivalent. And so one way to represent this equivalence class is to just push this time evolution to its to the point where you reach the null boundary itself, so the light-like boundary that corresponds to the future Cauchy evolution of this this region. On the other hand, what we are dealing here is with a problem in a finite region. And this is also related to the issue of coarse graining, namely how to coarse grain gravitational observables, how to go from smaller regions, how to go from observables defined in smaller regions to observables in larger regions. And one way of viewing this problem is to define the observables in one given region and then go to larger regions by gluing procedure. And finally, the third connection has to do with soft modes or infrared issues in gravity. In fact, the simplest Dirac observables that we can think of in quantum gravity are not really the radiative modes, but the observables such as mass, angular momentum, linear momentum, center of mass, and charges corresponding to higher multiples or supertranslations. And then the question is there a charge superselection? Should we quantize the theory only for one specific value of these charges, like mass, angular momentum, and so on? Or should we rather consider a Hilbert space where we allow for superpositions of these charges? And that, from an experimental point of view, that would actually make a lot of sense, because we can think of mesoscopic quantum systems that we put in superpositions of eigenvalues of center of mass, for instance, where you have a gravitational system where the source mass is in a superposition in position space. And of course, this is only also related to yet another issue, namely the issue for how to characterize the origin of black hole entropy. In other words, what are the microscopic states that, or the microscopic degrees of freedom that characterize, that give the origin to black hole entropy? And if we recall the first law of black hole thermodynamics, which tells you that the entropy goes like the area of the black hole, and the area is one of the of such charges, in fact, it makes makes a lot of sense to think of the origin of black hole entropy in this manner. Now, going to in order to characterize the gravitational degrees of freedom in finite regions, what happens is we have to introduce a boundary. But now gravity is a gauge theory. And what happens in gauge theories when you introduce a boundary is that you turn otherwise unphysical gauge degrees of freedom into physical boundary degrees of freedom. So what was an unphysical gauge direction before turns into a Dirac observable, into a physical degree of freedom. And the simplest example to understand this is, of course, electrodynamics, where the action defines both the equations of motion and the symplectic structure on field space. This slide is a bit introductory, and the main purpose of it is also to be a bit helpful for those in the audience, like students that are not familiar with this formalism. And so in the following, this bold B, D represents the differential, so differential forms or the exterior derivative on the infinite dimensional space of physical configurations of solutions to the field equations. And this is an infinite dimensional space. And then the question is how to turn it into a phase space. And you turn it into a phase space by introducing a symplectic structure, P's and Q's that are canonically conjugate, that are derived from the action. Now there are gauge symmetries, namely just the U1 gauge transformations of electrodynamics. And what you then find if you consider this symplectic structure in the presence of a boundary is that for a large gauge transformation, so for a gauge parameter lambda that does not vanish at the boundary of your three-dimensional region, that you obtain physical degrees of freedom, directions on phase space that are non-degenerate directions of this pre-symplectic two-form. And these are the charges, or rather the charge aspect, because you have infinitely many such observables, because the gauge parameter lambda at the boundary is arbitrary. And now we want to understand that in the case of gravity. Gravity, which is also a gauge theory like electrodynamics, just in a more nonlinear fashion. Now, we are dealing here with the problem of how to couple general relativity to boundaries. And we can think of this in the metric formalism. However, since we want to ultimately study all kinds of boundaries, so space-like boundaries, time-like boundaries, or null boundaries, it is actually way more appropriate to think in a first order formalism, where the fundamental configuration variables are differential forms. And why is that so? It is so because for differential forms, there exists a more primitive notion of projection, namely the pullback. The pullback that that sends differential forms that exist in the bulk into differential forms intrinsically defined on the boundary. And if we think in particular about null boundaries, this makes a lot of sense, because in the presence of a null boundary, we don't have a natural notion of projection, because the metric that lives on the light-like boundary is degenerate. So the fundamental configuration variables are the coframe field, the peer binds, the autonomous frames that are the square root of the metric, and the notion of parallel transport, connection, a Lorentz connection, A alpha beta. Alpha beta are internal indices. And then we have the action from which we derive the field equation. But the action also defines the symplectic structure. And it tells us that the two-form field, which is the wedge product of the tetrad, is canonically conjugate to the connection. Here we are still at like an introductory level, and boundary terms and boundary conditions will be more carefully studied below. Now, in this formalism, there are two distinguished gauge symmetries. On the one hand, you have internal Lorentz transformations that rotate your autonomous frames by infinitesimal Lorentz transformation, and they act in also on the connection field. And for any, just as in the case for electrodynamics, in fact, it's the analogy is perfect. You find an infinite number of Lorentz charges in your finite region, charges that are associated to these new gauge symmetries that you have in this formalism. However, it is also important to note that they do not exist in metric gravity. So these charges do not exist on the phase space or on the ADM phase space. And that may be an indication that they are truly physically meaningful, perhaps only if we allow for the presence of fermions, which then are defects of torsion. So they carry the charge that will be measured by this observable. More important are, of course, the diffeomorphisms, because they correspond, the corresponding charges measure what we mean by energy, angular momentum, and so on. And in this formalism, they are lifted upwards into the fiber bundle. So the action of an infinitesimal transform diffeomorphism is given by the leader derivative acting on this fundamental configuration variables. And if you then compute the charge by evaluating these vector fields by contracting these vector fields into the presymplectic two form, you can ask whether they are integrable, whether there is an observable whose Hamiltonian vector field is precisely this Lie derivative. Now, at linear order, this is trivially so. So there trivially exists at linear order a generator whose Hamiltonian vector fields are to linear order the Lie derivatives. And it's easy to check that if you ever evaluate these charges at infinity, so if you go at infinite distance from the source, they reproduce, provided you evaluate them for the right vector fields, they reproduce angular momentum, linear momentum, energy, and so on. So this charge evaluates to the ADM mass for linearized solution of the field equations around the asymptotically flat background. But now you can ask, is this always so? Does for any such diffeomorphism, if you consider it in a finite region, does there always exist such a charge that generates these motions and an observable peak psi? And there, the answer is no. And there's a physical reason why this is so. So let's consider this problem. Excuse me for a moment. So in gravity, time evolution the time evolution of a partial Cauchy hypersurface, which is locked into this finite region, can be understood as a large gauge transformation. A diffeomorphism that doesn't, which corresponds to a diffeomorphism that doesn't vanish at the boundary. And then, especially if you believe in something like ADS-CFT, it seems reasonable to expect that there is a Hamiltonian that perhaps corresponds to some boundary stress energy momentum tensor that generates this motion, that generates the evolution of your gravitational degrees of freedom along along the boundary. But on the other hand, we also want these generators, these charges, to generate the underlying symmetries. So we also know then that the Poisson brackets should satisfy a deformed version or a version with some a central extension of the diffeomorphism algebra in this region. However, this viewpoint is at odds with the fact that the system can lose degrees of freedom. So it's not a closed system. It's not a closed system because degrees of freedom can escape by leaving the boundary. And that then means, or that this implies, that the Hamiltonian cannot be conserved. In fact, if you go to null infinity, what you find is that the natural notion of Hamiltonian, the natural notion of energy, which is the bonding mass, is not conserved in time. It's not conserved because the system may lose gravitational radiation, which is recorded at infinity. And however, if you compute the time evolution of the charge just using this algebraic notion, then the charge must be conserved. So there's a tension. And the tension can only be resolved if you allow for an explicit time dependence of the Hamiltonian, of the charge, such that this equation is not true anymore, but the time derivative will have a symplectic term and a term that takes into account that there is an explicit time dependence of in your system. Let me explain this issue a bit more carefully in a very, very simplified setting, because fundamentally, what is the origin here is a careful distinction that we have to make, a distinction between what we mean by phase space and what we mean by the space of all physical configurations of all physical histories, or a distinction between field space and phase space. So to make this a bit more concrete, what I mean in here is the following. Consider a finite system, a small system, that can interact with its environment. And it can interact with its environment via some degrees of freedom that are localized at the boundary. And let's call these degrees of freedom omega I of t. And let's assume that the experimenter has some knobs and rods to to change these degree, to change the time dependence of these degrees of freedom as she wishes them to be. So these are basically your experimental, is basically your experimental input, like the length of a pendulum and so on. And then what is the Hamiltonian or the an action for such a system? Well, it consists of a symplectic term and some interaction term that tells you how the degrees of freedom inside interact with, let's say, the degrees of freedom here at the boundary that I call omega I of t. Now, the space of physical histories is corresponds to all configurations that the experimenter can make. So all possible choices for omega I of t and all possible initial conditions for the p's and q's. Phase space, however, is smaller. It only consists of the p's and q's for a particular choice of the boundary fields, of the parameters that the experimenter can choose. And the Hamiltonian of this system we can just read it off the action, contains an explicit time dependence. However, the time dependence only enters the Hamiltonian via these parameters that the experimenter can choose, some sort of background fields or sources. Now, in this toy model, of course, it's everything is trivial, and we know why there is this distinction between phase space and the space of physical histories, the space of all configurations that can be realized in the lab. However, in general relativity, we are not in this situation. We don't have this explicit splitting at hand. What we know is at least formally, the space of all physical histories, namely the space of all solutions to Einstein's equations in a given region, let's say. What we then do not know, however, is, or it may correspond to different choices we can make or to different boundary conditions, is the different phase spaces the observers can assign to this problem or to this region. In fact, if we now go back to our Hamiltonian and ask how does it depend on the configurations on the space of physical histories, we find the following equation. We find that there is a symplectic term, but there's an additional term which is not symplectic, which encodes the explicit time dependence of the Hamiltonian. So there is a term that takes care of the derivatives on phase space, the p's and q's, and it's the first term. And the second term takes care of the explicit time dependence of the Hamiltonian. And delta is in here a general, is a tangent vector on the space of physical histories. It is infinitesimal or it is a linearized solution of the field equations, where you also allow for variations of your background fields, of your boundary data, of your omega i's, of your omega, of your choices for the background field. And we will see later on how this equation is realized also in gravity. Now, in gravity, to characterize what we mean by gravitational subsystems, by gravitational subsystem, two choices must be made. The first choice is a choice of a region, to say, given a partial Cauchy hypersurface sigma, given a region in space, how did this three-dimensional region extends into a four-dimensional region? And there are infinitely many possibilities for doing this, of course. you can say you want to extend your 3D region along a time-like cylinder, but then you have to also specify what kind of cylinder this should be. Should it be an extremely surface or a surface of constant mean curvature, etc. And in the null case, or one particular choice is going to the extreme somehow to say that your boundary should be null. In addition to a choice of 4D region, you also have to specify the data on at the boundary. And the advantage of going to an R boundary is that there is a more immediate way to characterize the gravitational data that process the null surface. In addition, there is only data that can leak out, but nothing can go in. And in that way, it can enter the region or vice versa, which makes it also more concrete in a way, the problem. What is also important to note is that in dimensions smaller than 4, the second point disappears because there is no gravitational radiation in lower dimensions. And the only problem you have to deal with is to specify the shape of the boundary, so to say. And then the Hamiltonian is trivially conserved. So you get something like a boundary field theory simply because there are no modes leaking out of your region. And in that way, lower dimensional gravity is trivially holographic in a way. And so now I have to make a choice as prescribed. And the choice that I'm gonna make is to say that the boundary should be null, because in that case, there's a more concrete way to characterize the degrees of freedom that live on the boundary. And we will now come to that. And in order to do that, and in order to relate the degrees of freedom in a finite region to those that live at an asymptotic boundary, it is useful to introduce a double null foliation of spacetime. So normally when we want to describe gravitational radiation, we often work in a bonding gauge. In that case, that we have a foliation of space-time into null surfaces, three-dimensional null surfaces, which are U equal constant surfaces for some retarded time coordinate U. In addition, so this surface is null such that it's a normal vector, which I call Ka, lies itself tangential to the surface. And what is then most commonly imposed are the following gauge conditions. You introduce a tetrad, an orthonormal frame at some initial point, and you simply propagate this null tetrad, so this orthonormal frame, outwards using outwards along this null directions using the parallel transport. However, what you then have is that the dual null vectors, so the ones that go in, are not surface orthogonal. So there are no, the ingoing direction, the ingoing null direction does not form surfaces. And the R equal, so there's also a radial coordinate, and the R equal constant surfaces are not are typically time-like, not null. However, so these gauge choices are very common in the literature, However, they are not so advantageous for us. And the reason is that we want to describe the gravitational bulk plus boundary degrees of freedom in finite regions whose boundary is null. And here only one half of the boundary is light-like. So what we rather need is a double null foliation, where the outgoing null directions are surface orthogonal as well as the ingoing null directions. Obviously, at some point, this coordinate system will break down. So we have to cut these regions off before any caustics may form. And then the coordinates are similar to what we have before, a retarded time coordinate such that the U equal constant surfaces are null. And but then there are also the ingoing null surfaces, and they are rho equal constant surfaces where rho is the inverse conformal factor. So we impose the condition that conformal factor that level surfaces of the conformal factor are null, and the limit to infinity is the limit of sending omega to zero. What is now different to the previous gauge conditions is that the null tetrad that we can then introduce is not any longer parallelly propagated along the outgoing null directions. And however, there is a remnant of this gauge condition that we can impose, which fixes a U1 gauge freedom that basically selects a two-dimensional autonomal basis on these two-dimensional cross sections where the ingoing and outgoing light cones intersect. And these gauge conditions are more advantageous for our purpose because for every rho, we have now a finite region. And in these finite regions, we can now characterize the bulk plus boundary degrees of freedom, and then take the limit where the boundary or this portion of the boundary reaches null infinity. And in addition, the vector field, the outgoing vector field is null and also affinely parametrized. And this cannot be true simultaneously for the ingoing null vector field. So there's some non-affinity that characterizes how much the ingoing vector field deviates from being affinely parametrized. What is then nice is that although these gauge conditions are somewhat different than the body gauge conditions that are normally used in the literature, the follow-up conditions are essentially the same. And what is important here is that the outgoing shear. So now you have two null congruences, one going out, one going in, and the shear of the outgoing null congruence falls off like 1/r², while the fall off of the ingoing null congruence is like 1/r. And the coefficient that appears in this expansion will then characterize the gravitational radiation at the two modes of gravitational radiation at infinity. Furthermore, you get the usual, assuming that there are no logarithmic divergences, you get the same peeling properties for the components of the Weyl tensor as in the standard bond leakage. Now, all this is still true for, what I've told you in the last two slides is about one specific space-time. What you want, what we want to do next is to use these Polov conditions and this parametrization to coordinates on phase space. So now we want to speak not about one solution of Einstein's equations, but about phase space. So many solutions. And now we have to understand how to couple, how to impose the boundary conditions, basically, and to describe what is the data that we keep fixed at a generic, at the finite such non-boundary. And these will be the 2 degrees of freedom per point of gravitational radiation that crosses the null boundary. Now, as mentioned earlier, when we work with the null surface, it's just more handy. It just comes in more useful to work with differential forms rather than metric tensors. And in gravity, this is particularly important for the loop gravity approach to quantum gravity. What is the momentum conjugate to the connection is a directed area two form. And if we decompose it into its self-dual and anti-self-dual parts, contracting this two form with the gamma matrices, what happens is that this two form has a very simple algebraic structure on an hypersurface. Namely, it turns into the symmetrized tensor product between a single spinor, the null flag LA, and a conjugate spinor. Now, the boundary is a three-dimensional surface. This null surface is three-dimensional, and the conjugate momentum to a scalar in three dimensions is a two-form, and therefore the conjugate momentum is to this spinor-valued field, to this spinor, is a spinor-valued two-form that turns out to parametrize the directed area two form, which is in the bulk is canonically conjugate to the connection. And if you contract these two spinors, you get a two form that is uncharged under SL2C. And the geometric significance of this two form is that it measures the area of any two-dimensional cross-section of your null boundary. And now we can construct the action and identify the boundary conditions on the null portion of the boundary. So in the bulk, we have the usual Hilbert-Palatini action in terms of these spinor-valued fields. At the boundary, we can easily build a boundary term out of these boundary intrinsic fields that are charged under SL2C, simply by taking the covariant derivative with respect to the connection in the bulk. And notice that this boundary term is essentially a symplectic structure, the term PDQ on this null boundary. And kappa is a one form intrinsic to the boundary that will play a role in that I need to introduce in order to specify my boundary conditions. So what are the boundary conditions? So all these fields are alive, so to say. So they will be part of phase space. And they are unconstrained under the boundary conditions. What is constrained on the null boundary is a triple of boundary fields that consist of this one form, which is essentially a connection on the null boundary, a connection under dilatations, the null direction itself, and a complex valued one form at the boundary that is the square root of your degenerate metric at the boundary. So M and M bar are autonomous frames, co-frame fields in 2+1 dimensions. And the intrinsic metric on the boundary is the tensor product of M and M bar, as described in here. So this is the 2D degenerate metric on the null boundary. And this, here I've explained again the geometric significance of the boundary fields. So L is a representative of your null direction. Kappa is a one form that transforms as a connection under dilatations, and it measures the non-affinity. And the M and M bar are your autonomous frames on the null boundary. And what are now the boundary conditions? The boundary conditions are to say that a gauge equivalence class of this triple of fields is kept fixed at the boundary. A gauge equivalence class under which transformations, under which gauge symmetries? Well, they are listed here. So these are diffeomorphisms generated by the null direction, dilatations of the null normal, complexified conformal transformations of your boundary diet, in addition to this, in addition to a shift symmetry of your of this connection one form at the boundary. And if you do the counting, so if you ask yourself, well, I have these fields intrinsic to the boundary. If I divide out these equivalence relations, how many degrees of freedom are there left? Well, you will find that there are 2 degrees of freedom left inside the on any point on this null boundary. You may also want to ask, what is the universal structure here? What is shared between different spacetimes? Now, often what is kept fixed is an equivalence class of these null generators and the non-affinity. In here, this is not done, in fact, for a reason. And the reason is that if you cut your null surface off, so if you introduce these, sorry for going backwards, but if you introduce these disks, what you then find is that the dilatations are not anymore gauge, that you have a charge associated to them, which is just the area. So you can't really divide out this gauge symmetry globally. And therefore you cannot fix this between different spacetimes. The only thing that is fixed between, so the only remnant of the universal of this universal structure is the ruling of the null hypersurface. Of the null boundary. So what is kept fixed is the direction of these null generators, but not their relative length, so to say. So the direction in which these lines are shared between different spacetimes, but no notion of length of these null generators. then. So then what you then find is that the variational principle is well posed. So you have a bulk plus boundary action, and the boundary conditions only fix 2 degrees of freedom along your null boundary, which is what you want, because it amounts to only fix physical degrees of freedom as opposed to some redundant gauge degrees of freedom. And if you then go into the, if you then compute the first variation of the action, you obtain the symplectic structure on a generic such null boundary. Notice that this is still at a finite region. But now that we have introduced this double null foliation, we can actually send this null boundary to infinity and see what will be left after imposing the follow-up conditions. And what turns out to happen is that only the second term survives, this shear term, and the variation of the of this codyad, so this complex valued one form at the boundary, can itself be parameterized by the outgoing shear. Whereas the incoming shear is turns out to be just the time derivative of the outgoing shear. So you get this, you recover the usual presymplectic, the usual symplectic structure of the two radiative modes at null infinity. You can, however, also do somehow the opposite. Instead of going to all the way to null infinity, you go to a specific null surface in the interior of the manifold, namely an isolated horizon, for instance. In the case of an isolated horizon, the expansion vanishes, which by the Rajchaudhuri equation then also implies that the shear vanishes, which by the way is the generator of diffeomorphisms along the null generators. And what you will be left with is only this second term, which is precisely this first term, which is precisely the symplectic structure on an isolated horizon that tells you that there is one form which is canonically conjugate to the area of your horizon, of a cross section of the horizon. Then you can also ask what are, so now something crucial is happening. So before we were looking at the phase, so before meaning on this slide, we were looking at the gravity degrees of freedom on a null hypersurface. But now this finite region has a boundary that consists of different parts. And just as we have assigned here a symplectic structure to the null boundary, we can also introduce the resulting symplectic potential on these spatial disks. So these disks that are entered on the null hypersurface. And then you find two terms. So you find that you have the usual symplectic structure that tells you that the connection is canonically conjugate to the to this directed to the Plebansky two form, to this direct to the directed area. But in addition to that, by introducing a boundary, you have excited additional boundary modes. And in this formalism, you find that the null the flag of the boundary, so the spin order parameterizes the null direction, is canonically conjugate to the has a conjugate momentum, which is a spin-valued two form. The gauge symmetries are simultaneous frame rotations in the Balkan boundary, and diffeomorphisms that vanish at the corner. In addition, there is this U1 gauge symmetry that corresponds to rotations of this of these Spinor-valued fields. Then you find that then you can ask what are the simplest observables that you can construct. And they are tangential diffeomorphisms, so generalized angular momenta, and dilatations of these boundary fields. The corresponding charge is the area. So the area density plays the role of the charge aspect of QED for this dilatation symmetry. And however, the whole point of my talk was to speak about energy. So let us now evaluate, let us try to infer what is the underlying phase space for which there is a Hamiltonian. All right, so if you remember what we said earlier, if we are considering an open system, then a generic a variation of your Hamiltonian on the infinite dimensional space of physical histories consists of two terms, a symplectic term that takes care of the variation of the dependence of the Hamiltonian with respect to the P's and Q's of your theory. But in addition to that, there's another term that takes care of the explicit time dependence of the Hamiltonian. So these are the derivatives with respect to the background fields, the sources that drive the time dependence of the Hamiltonian. And if you now do the analogous computation for the gravitational system, you find that there is an Hamiltonian which is integrable on the space of physical histories, the space of all solutions to Einstein's equation, where the explicit time dependence of your Hamiltonian is now governed by the boundary symplectic structure on the null hypersurface. And what I like to stress is that this entire calculation happens at the level of, this uses covariant phase space methods, but the variation that you are considering here is actually not just like in our toy model, is not a tangent vector to phase space. It is a tangent vector where, on a larger space, namely the space of all solutions to Einstein's equations for all possible boundary conditions. But to have a phase space, you have to go to a smaller space, namely a space where some of the boundary or where the boundary data is kept fixed. And the relevant boundary data in here is the boundary data on the null hypersurface. The radiation that leaks out of your null hypersurface and then drives the time dependence of your Hamiltonian which is then characterized by the outgoing shear, which happens to govern the time dependence of the bonding mass according to the bonding mass loss formula at infinity. In fact, you can now ask what happens if I go to infinity and evaluate this Hamiltonian at future null infinity, at the cross section of future null infinity. And what you find is the following. You find that this notion of energy is related to the bonding mass, which is this particular combination of spin coefficients. So psi 2 is a component of the Weyl tensor. But the two differ, and they differ by a term that goes like the area of your cross section times the non-affinity of your ingoing null generators, which is like a surface gravity. So in other words, at infinity. So what you have here has, you may give it a, or the Hamiltonian is related to the, so the resulting Hamiltonian is related to the bonding mass by something like a Deschondre transform. So in other words, if you now insist that that area should be related to entropy, what you get is that that the Hamiltonian that generates the evolution along the null generators is the free energy of your system, odd system. So what are the degrees of freedom that evolve under this Hamiltonian flow? So let me go to this slide. So what is actually evolving? What we get in here, what we get on this line is a Hamiltonian that is integrable for specific boundary conditions. What are these boundary conditions? Well, this becomes a Hamiltonian, H is a Hamiltonian with respect to the P's and Q's in your phase space. And the P's and Q's are inferred by keeping omega fixed. Now, in here, keeping the background fields fixed amounts to keeping the outgoing shear fixed. So in other words, keeping the radiation fixed, the outgoing radiation fixed. So all what is left to evolve with respect to this Hamiltonian are the boundary modes alone. And perhaps some additional data that goes in if there is a singularity, but let's forget about it. In that case, all the radiative degrees of freedom on your Cauchy hypersurface are now translated into these background fields at infinity, into these sources that play the role of the omega, of the omegas in our toy model. But the claim is that then there's still something left. Then there's still a phase space left. And the phase space that will be left or that is left in here is the phase space of the edge modes, of the boundary modes alone. And why does this viewpoint make sense? Because in my opinion, it is exactly what happens in lower dimensions. In lower dimensions, there is no gravitational radiation to begin with, which is as if in higher dimensions we keep the radiation fixed. But then there's still something that evolves. In lower dimensions, this is very well known. In lower dimensions, in lower dimensional gravity, if you consider the gravitational bulk plus boundary degrees of freedom in a cylinder, what you find is that there are no degrees of freedom inside, and all what you're left with are the boundary degrees of freedom alone that then evolve according to some dual field theory. A dual field theory that depends on the boundary conditions chosen. And the idea of this viewpoint is that the same can be done in higher dimensions at the expense of keeping something fixed along the null boundary, which is the radiative data. But once you keep it fixed and thereby remove all radiative modes from your Cauchy hypersurface, are the edge modes that then evolve along this null boundary. I think this viewpoint is important because to understand, for instance, the microscopic origin of the entropy of black holes, we don't really need to look at the radiative degrees of freedom, because what the first law of black hole thermodynamics can be derived just from covariant phase space methods. And if we do that, we realize that what appears in here in this law are only edge modes. So this should be a way to a road to understanding also their realization in quantum theory. And I think I stop with this, and I think perhaps this slide could also give us some guidance or for discussions. Thank you.
Thanks, Wolfgang, for this very nice and interesting talk. So are there questions from students first? Okay, seems like there are no questions from students for now. Does anybody have questions or comments? Seth?
Hi. Thank you, Wolfgang, for the talk. I have maybe two questions. So the first one is, so you're talking about for if you fix the gravitational radiation on your null surface, do you then reduce to like, because you're talking about, then you still expect some edge mode or boundary degrees of freedom. So the question is like, when you fix this gravitational radiation, does your system reduce to like a topological system? Because in the lower dimensions, it's a topological theory. That's why you have only these boundary degrees of freedom and null. And the second question also has to do with, you mentioned two choices for describing like a gravitational in a boundary or like in a finite region. And so the first choice has to do with how the region fits into four dimensional spacetime. And the second choice had to do with choosing the degrees of freedom on the boundary. And the question is, does this degree of freedom depend on the boundary you already choose? So in the sense that if I choose like a space-like boundary or time-like boundary instead of now, as you've chosen, will this second choice depend on this in such a way that maybe I don't get this gravitational radiation anymore?
Thank you. Thank you very much for these questions. So as regards to your first question, In the lower, or the way I would phrase the lower dimensional example is that the theory is topological in the bulk, and then you are only left with the boundary, with the theory at the boundary. Mm-hmm. And uh, in in what I'm trying to describe in here is a framework where, so where from the beginning, the theory in the bulk is of course not topological. However, by fixing the radiative modes that go, that pass through the boundary, you have a way to be only left with a boundary field theory alone. In other words, it allows you to integrate out the bulk by fixing the degrees of the radiative degrees of freedom at the boundary, and then evolving the edge modes for given boundary data along the null generators. So it's not that I want to say that now in the now the theory in the bulk is suddenly topological. It's only a way to infer a boundary field theory for given boundary conditions along the null hypersurface. Now, for your other question, so there, so that it's true that null surfaces are special in the sense that you only there's only data that can go out, and therefore it and the surface is equipped with more structure that allows you to say more clearly what where you can separate more clearly what these two different choices. You see, because in the for instance, in the time-like case, it is not as immediate to say what are the related degrees of freedom and what are just gauge choices for specifying how this boundary sits in the bulk. While in the case of the null hypersurface, this is more immediate because it is adapted to speaking about radiation. Just because the boundary itself follows the evolution of radiation. Of course, there is now doing things like this. There's a catch, or there's something hiding. Namely, it's the data that doesn't go out, doesn't go in because nothing can go in, but that travels along this this boundary. And this is not local. On this surface, but itself localized on the boundary of this, on the co-dimension two boundary. And one way to study it is to look at two such regions and gluing them together along this null boundary, because then you can allow for a discontinuity across this boundary that then represents precisely the data that travels along the null generators. So this is my answer to your question.
Yeah, thank you.
There is one more question by hand.
Yeah, hello.
Hello.
So by the choice, I guess you are just implicitly thinking about just the cylinder. When you say you want to, you know, you have two Cauchy surfaces and then you have a cylinder between them.
Yes.
Okay, so because I know in dimension four, there are like there are difficulties in saying whether a four dimensional, or rather 3+1 dimensional cobordism is isomorphic to the cylinder. So I was just wondering, like, what if we pick something like that's exotic, right? What happens if we have stuff that is more like, for example, have holes in them, or just have like self-intersection and stuff like that? Can we even define what the outgoing fluxes or ingoing fluxes or whatever, what that means?
Well, the outgoing flux is local on this. So the outgoing flux is represented by 2 degrees of freedom per point on this null boundary. So to do something like you are suggesting, what I would suspect is what you have to do is to cut this null boundary into pieces and reassemble it. And this would not affect the radiative modes, because in any case they are local on that surface. However, it would introduce it can only introduce non-local observables,
right.
That arise from this suing and gluing together.
Mm-hmm. So what would that mean, like in the context of gravity?
Well, it would mean that, for instance, if you want to study how two black holes collide, for instance, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Then you would have to, and you want to speak about the degrees of freedom that live on the event horizon that mm-hmm. forms if these two black holes merge, then you are dealing with a situation that is that has a different topology, where you have mm-hmm. like a pants or something like that.
And right.
That's where these things become important. But the way I would think of them is to say that this is the elementary building block, the fundamental system out of which you generate more complicated systems by a gluing procedure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Are there more questions or comments? Laurent?
Hello, Wolfgang. Yeah, I have a few questions. Thank you for this nice talk. It's good to see you. I have several questions. One question is about, I'm not sure I completely got what you wanted to say about asymptotic infinity with respect to this notion of free energy and internal energy. Is one a canonical energy? I mean, could you... I understood that one would be a canonical energy, and then you would call the Bondi mass the free energy.
Yes.
I thought that the Bondi mass is also a canonical energy. It's also a canonical charge. So could you maybe...
Yes. Thanks. So the way I think of this is that... So in here, I'm... okay.
And then say why you think it's important to distinguish this notion of energies, or what do you have in mind?
Yes. All right. So the reason is that in here, so H is the canonical notion of energy. The canonical note for a specific choice of vector field, namely a vector field that is not only null at infinity, but it is also null if you go inwards into the bulk. So in other words, this is not the type of energy, excuse me, that you would, this is not the type of time translation that you have in mind when you think that the Bondi mass is canonical.
Okay, okay.
Because the Bondi mass corresponds to an asymptotic time translation where you also, which is a combination of the outgoing and the ingoing null dimension, where the generator is time-like. While in here, I'm considering a generator that is null, but null also if you go inwards into the bulk.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay, that's good.
The two differ because by a term that gives you the radial evolution. The asymptotic time translation is the combination of the ingoing null direction and the linear combination of the ingoing null direction and the outgoing null direction. And the outgoing null direction is the generator of the radial evolution. Mm-hmm. And so the statement is that there are now two notions of energy, and they differ by this term. And
can I ask about that term?
Yes.
What is that in, like, if you just set up Bondi gauge, what is that epsilon times kappa? Like, what does it evaluate to?
So kappa, so I can go back to, kappa itself evaluates to psi 2. So its limit is itself. So if there's no radiation, then it evaluate. It has a finite limit,
mm-hmm.
and the limit. So then these terms. So this term is just a boundary term. This term goes away,
uh-huh.
and they are just proportional.
So.
Sorry, did you say it cancels the psi 2 that's in the Bondi energy? Is that what happens?
No, there are... no.
You have like MB is the first line, and then you said this kappa is psi 2?
Mm-hmm. So this is like one half of psi 2 or something.
Oh, so it just...
So one is like one half of the other.
Okay. Oh, the whole thing is down by a factor of 2, you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay.
And why do you call, you must have something in mind when you call this subtraction free energy versus, or is it?
Just the analogy with black hole thermodynamics, because if you, now you have, now you can do the same procedure at an inner boundary, and mm-hmm. there this term just evaluates to, if you evaluate, if you choose psi to be the killing, then this term just evaluates to epsilon, the area, times the surface gravity.
Mm-hmm.
So this has this then really becomes entropy times inverse temperature, such that the two terms are related by a Legendre transform. Mm-hmm. That one is the canonical energy, and the other one, so Bondi mass at infinity, would be the free energy.
But didn't you say kappa was the infinity of like the auxiliary direction? It's not the infinity of the null generator?
Or no, is it? It's the null generator.
the infinity of the thing that's generating the null surface, that's your boundary. Is that what you said?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
I have a somewhat technical question about, it kind of in relationship with this discussion of revealing at infinity most of the edge mode structure, or let's say the super rotation. But before that, somehow I would imagine that because you're in double null, somehow you're kind of fixing certain gauge there. You're fixing more gauge degrees of freedom than in Bondi. Can you make sure that you're not somehow killing certain charges that I would expect that you're fixing some component of the normal metric to the sphere, and these ones, some of these components become physical. So I understand for the description you want to have in the quasi-local, and that's where you want to start, but at some point you see where I'm going?
I see what you're going. So what I want to stress is, yes, these are different conditions that we have in the usual Bondi story, but they are not more restrictive than that. It's just that I set other spin coefficients to zero that are non-vanishing in the Bondi frame, but at the expense of turning on other spin coefficients. So it's not that one gauge is more restrictive than another. They're just that I'm fixing the same number of spin coefficients, just different ones, so to say.
Yeah. I agree with you if you talk about the usual BMS story, right? But I was trying to make reference to the modern version of the BMS story, where people have extended the phase space. So that is, where you just have much more than the radiative degrees of freedom in your asymptotic phase space. And I can see maybe you're not there yet, or you're still in the usual Bondi framework. By usual Bondi framework, I mean that at infinity, you only have the symplectic structure that you showed, only has the radiative degrees of freedom. That is the one written by Abai a long time ago. Whereas now, if you look at what Comperé is doing, people can include now all these super rotation memory effect type of degrees of freedom. So maybe it's more for the future.
Yeah.
But that's correct, right? You're so far you're just connecting to the usual Bondi. Not the extended.
Well, still I get charges for. The way I think of this is that you have to look at different, that you have to look at different phase spaces. So there's one phase space that is the phase space of the just the radiative modes. But to characterize, to get a hand on like angular momentum, as you were saying, or super rotations, and that you. I would say you should look at a different phase space, a phase space that is assigned to a partially Cauchy hypersurface that is entered at null infinity. And there you can evaluate charges and you get all of them, all the diffeomorphism charges that deform your cross section, and if you evaluate this charge on an area preserving diffeomorphism of this two sphere boundary, you just get the corresponding angular moments that have been defined in the literature, which is also proportional to psi 2, just the imaginary part rather than the real part of psi 2. And maybe just one more, perhaps unrelated thing is that another advantage of using this double null foliation is that mass positivity is now, or showing that the Bondi mass law is satisfied, that the flux of Bondi energy is always positive, is almost trivial. In fact, it's just the subleading terms of the Ricciardo-Ri equation, which have a definite sign. In fact, what the Bondi mass aspect is in the double null foliation is just the subleading term of the ingoing expansion. And now you can ask, why is there no
what is C, R of C? Sorry, I forgot to ask.
Right, what is R? Exactly, that's why I'm now going. In fact, R of C, R is the 2D Ricci scalar of these cross sections.
Okay.
And if you do this calculation, what you find is at first hand, it seems to diverge. So you seem to get a term that that does not have a limit as you go to infinity. However, what this equation shows you is that you don't really calculate H, but only its variation. And this divergent term is just the integral of the 2D Ricci scalar of these 2D cross sections times the metrical area density. And this is just the Euler characteristic of your boundary, which whose variation is zero on phase space because it's a topologically invariant. And so that's the way that the IR divergent term falls out of this calculation, and you're then just left with the next two leading order, which gives you of the ingoing expansion, which returns the Bondi mass aspect.
Mm-hmm. Are there questions?
Do you want to say a word about quantum gravity?
There are now different strategies for going to quantum gravity. So one is truncations like imposing spherical symmetry. Another is asymptotic quantization, where you go to infinity, where at which point your symplectic structure simplifies and you're just left with essentially harmonic oscillators for these two radiative degrees of freedom. And yet another, I would say there are three strategies for quantizing. One is truncation, like going, as I said, imposing, for instance, spherical symmetry, then asymptotic quantization, where you go all the way to infinity, at which point the Poisson commutation relations are just those for harmonic oscillators, or doing something that is closer to what we do in loop gravity or spin forms, like you and Laurent and the Bianca, namely to impose conditions on the degrees of freedom in the inside, to say that you start out with bulk plus boundary degrees of freedom in the finite region. You impose that inside there are no degrees of freedom, and you create non-trivial geometries by gluing these causal patches together. So I think these, and I think what we need to do is understand how they are related and how they fit together, how they are different sides of the same thing.
Okay, so one last question by Kazan.
Hi, I've got a very nice talk. I really enjoyed it. So I know I'm always saying the same thing, but I mean, when you're talking about quantization, you mentioned asymptotic quantization. So you're probably thinking about these ideas of Ashtekar, right? So this kind of a thing. I'm sure you know that, you know, there's this more kind of modern take on that using the BVBFV formalism. And they have this paper with Michele Schiavina, where we looked at QED and the asymptotic structure in QED in the classical sense. But I mean, this can probably easily, I'm sure this can easily be done also for gravity. And this would, I guess this would, I don't think it would provide a new way to the three you mentioned, but maybe yet another take on asymptotic quantization, where you have some sort of relation between the asymptotic structure and the sort of bulk structure, and there are some like consistency conditions between those. It all looks really good. It looks like something that one should try on the structure. So I was wondering if you thought about it.
Yes, I agree, absolutely. And I think also that there's no reason really to go to all the way to infinity. You should be able to do everything at a finite distance.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, yeah, so actually the way we do it with Michele, we have like a finite boundary and then take the limit, but we could just work with the finite boundary. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. I see.
It's just that you have then a slightly larger phase space and you obtain the asymptotic, the phase space for an asymptotic boundary by introducing additional constraints that tell you that some of your phase space variables tell you that you are at infinity rather than at finite distance.
Thanks for giving such a complete overview of this work. This is lovely.
Thank you.
Okay, so I think it is a good point to close the discussion, and I would suggest that now you all unmute yourself to thank Wolfgang again.